Hello, everybody. Warren Smith with you, and I'd like to welcome you to the Ministry Watch podcast. On today's program, I have a conversation with Nancy French. Now, I've known Nancy for probably a dozen years, maybe more, and you know, you would occasionally see her on conservative talk shows or as a spokesperson, for example, for the Mitt Romney campaign. She was the leader of evangelicals for Romney at one point during her political career. But I've got to say that she was probably not as much of a household name in American politics as was even her husband, David French. That's because she mostly operated behind the scenes. That said, she was well known at the very highest levels of Republican circles, and that's because she was a ghostwriter. She was a ghostwriter for politicians and conservative celebrities. She often wrote speeches and sound bites and prepared politicians for public appearances. In fact, she's had 5 books that she ghostwrote for others find their way onto the New York Times bestseller list. But a few years ago, she found that the Republican Party was going down a path that she could not travel with them. And eventually, her political clients abandoned her. She did continue to write, though, and she did some major investigative work for The Dispatch on the sexual and spiritual abuse at Kanakuk camps, America's largest Christian camp, which is a story that we covered here at Ministry Watch as well. Now she has come completely out of the shadows, you might say, and has a new book under her own name. It's called Ghosted, An American Story. I've read the book. In fact, my wife is reading it now, and we have both found it to be fascinating, a look at her early life of poverty in the South and the long road that she took to success, with a lot of challenges that she's had along the way. I was really pleased that Nancy agreed to have this conversation with me, and we were able to have it via Zoom. I hope you enjoy it. Well, Nancy, I've been excited for, I don't know, a week or 10 days ever since we arranged this for you to be on the program, because I got to tell you, I really loved your book, Ghosted, An American Story. My wife is reading it now. In fact, I had to pry the book from her hands in order to have it in front of me for this interview. So congratulations on the book. Congratulations on what appears to me a successful book launch. I see you all over the place on social media. So yeah, congratulations.
Thanks for having me on the show. This is fun.
So, Nancy, I want to begin. I want to mostly talk about your book, though not completely talk about your book. So let's begin there with the book. Tell me a little about your early life and, you know, some of the anecdotes that you recounted in your book.
Yeah. So my family is from Montego Mountain in Tennessee, which is in the foothills of the Appalachians. And yeah, my family, they were a coal mining family, a large family, self-identified as hillbillies. My dad, when he was 15, got off the mountain by lying about his age and birthday and name, and he joined the Marine Corps at 15, spent 3 years in the service, and then came back to high school. And so eventually he used that to get off the mountain. And so I was raised in Mayfield, Kentucky, which is Western Kentucky, and Paris, Tennessee, which is Western Tennessee, but raised by these wonderful, you know, hillbilly parents. And so I sort of had, when I say the best of both worlds, you know, it was like I was being raised in sort of a more rural setting, not the mountain setting, but I sort of had both influences.
Yeah. Well, Nancy, I don't want to hijack your story, but as I read this, a lot of light bulbs went off for me. My parents were married in Paris, Tennessee.
No way.
Yeah, exactly. I know. They were from Martin and Dresden, Tennessee, which is just a little bit west of there. And I did my master's thesis on Andrew Lytle, who lived in the Monteagle Assembly for the last probably 40 years of his life. So I was very familiar with Monteagle Mountain, and you know, and Monteagle is kind of an unusual place because you got Suwannee nearby. It's kind of both very highly educated Brahmin South, you know, blue blood, along with the hillbillies sort of living side by side there.
Right. Uh-huh. Yeah. I think my family helped build, you know, put together that university, like in terms of like construction. But yeah, it's an interesting place. When I talk to people about Monteagle, they usually have more experience with the more educated parts of the area. But yeah, they're both there, intermingling peacefully, I hope.
Yeah, I think for the most part, yeah, that's right. Nancy, as a young person, you know, your family, I guess you could say, maybe had kind of a hardscrabble existence, but you were active in church, but you had a pretty negative experience in church whenever you were a child with a young man, then young man named Conrad. Can you describe that story?
Yeah. So I loved going to church, Warren. I loved church. I went 3 times a week. You know, you did Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday night. We'd shut down the building after church. You know, the deacons would flicker the lights. We were the people there that, you know, would just, it was our social life. It was our spiritual life. It was our cultural life. It was everything. And then my vacation Bible school teacher, who was about 10 years older than I was when I was approximately 12, he sexually abused me. And so it sort of pushed me to the outskirts of my community, the community that I loved so much, because he was always there and no one knew about what had happened. And so I was pushed to the outskirts, and it made me sort of turn, not on God necessarily, but just it made me unable to be comfortable in church. And that had ramifications for me, you know, that I'm still sort of experiencing.
Yeah. Well, and it also, to a certain extent, informed your career, I guess. We're going to come to a bit more of that later, Nancy. But, you know, I think the fact that you didn't completely turn on God and completely turn on Christianity, but you developed a healthy skepticism for the people in power within the church, I would say that's a defining characteristic of your life and career today. Would you say that?
I would, but only now, Warren. So I sort of have, I think, honestly, and I feel like you would understand this more than most, I feel like I spent most of my life hiding behind other people's stories. So I'm a celebrity ghostwriter. For many years, I was sort of the celebrity ghostwriter for the GOP. And then I switched to Hollywood and I worked with like Kim Kardashian and Sean Lowe, The Bachelor, and Sean Johnson, the Olympic athlete. But for many years, I just always took other people's stories and I sort of hid behind them. And I was happy with that. And then about 3 years ago, I was contacted by Gretchen Carlson to investigate Kanakuk camps in Branson, Missouri, because they had a sexual abuse issue. They have a sexual abuse issue that is unresolved and hidden. And I did not want to deal with this because of my history. And in fact, many people had reached out to me and asked me to write about sexual abuse. And I said no, because I didn't want to write about it, didn't want to know about it, didn't want to think about it. But when Gretchen contacted me about Kanakuk, I realized that it was ongoing and that I needed, that children were in danger. And so I felt like my personal story animated me and catalyzed me to make the decision that I had to do something, because when I was abused as a kid, adults knew about it, definitely suspected it, but some adults knew about it. And so suddenly when Gretchen told me about Kanakuk, I became one of those adults who know about it. So once you know about it, you have to be grown, you know, you have to be grown and do the right thing. So I sort of came into my own about 3 years ago and decided to not set aside, but sort of honor my story and try to seek justice for other sexual abuse victims in the context of the church.
I want to talk a little more about Kanakuk in a minute, but I want to go back, if I could, Nancy, to the unfolding story of your life. And we'll catch up with the Kanakuk story in a little bit, and ask you to tell a couple of other quick stories from the early chapters of your book that that really stood out to me, and I know to my wife as well, as she's been reading the book. And one of them is the stories, I guess, two young men, Jacob and Liam. Would you tell what happened when you were, I guess it was late high school, early college years?
Yes, this does not reflect well on me, Warren, but I was dating two guys at the same time, and they both went to the University of Tennessee, which you think wouldn't be a problem because there's 20,000 people there, but they did find each other, and one of them tried to kill me, and the other one saved me. So it was like one of these very dramatic things where because I'd been sexually abused, it sort of put me on a path of terrible decision-making. And I did not date the right people. And so there was this one guy named Jacob that I just could not break up with. It sounds weird. And I know people have a difficult time understanding this, but like he kept manipulating me and saying that if I broke up with him, he would die, he would kill himself. And so I kept trying to ameliorate the pain of the breakup. And the more I did that, the more angry he became at me. And so he set me up basically. And, but the boyfriend number two came in and saved the day with a big group of fraternity brothers and saved my life. And very thankful for that. But all of that preceded meeting David A. French, who I came to know, you know, maybe a year after that. When he shows up in the picture, things, you know, change for the better.
Yeah. And I do want to get to the fact I've got a question specifically about David French and another David that I want you to talk about in just a minute. But before we do that, I also want you to quickly tell the story of your friend Virginia, because again, I'm skipping a lot in the book, Nancy, and you know this, but I just for our listeners' benefit, I'm skipping a lot, but I'm focusing on these stories because in my view, as I read the book, these seem to be real defining moments in your life. One of them, again, was the story of your good friend Virginia. Tell me about Virginia and what happened to her.
Yeah, Virginia was this beautiful 6-foot-tall blonde friend of mine that I met at Lipscomb the first day I was there for orientation. She was amazing. Loved her so much. And the reason why I included her in the book, not only is because she was important to me and I think about her constantly, but she and I had this bond. And one morning I woke up and I had this really incredible detailed dream that she had died in a very specific way. And she died that day in that very specific way. And that is the type of thing. I feel like maybe a lot of your listeners have stories like this where you're like, I feel like I encountered some supernatural thing, but I don't know how to process it. I also don't understand it. I don't understand the reasoning behind it. And I can't tell a theologian about it in ways that make sense. And I feel like a lot of people have these encounters with these supernatural. And so in my book, I just decided to include them. And they're not tidy and they don't quite make sense. And I've never been able to make sense of them in my life. But there was something about writing them down and saying, hey, these weird spiritual things happen to me. Do they happen to you? That I think is sort of nice to hear. You know, I feel like we're sort of physical beings. And we occasionally have these glimpses into the supernatural. And so I just included them in my book because I think they're interesting.
Yeah. Well, I found them to be fabulously interesting. And, you know, in some ways, one of the things that is interesting about the Virginia story in particular was that while it was a horrible tragedy, a beautiful young woman dying in a car accident, in some ways, it was that story that maybe more fully opened you up to seeing God and seeing God at work in the world. I know you'd love to have your friend back and have that insight, but that's what I took from that story. Was I misreading that story in any way?
No, I think you're right. I was completely decimated by her death to the point of almost causing my own death. And I never would be the same from that, after that, after her death. And there was something about being completely, it was like my rock bottom when she died, that sort of opened me up to, I think, being more spiritually curious, later and spiritually receptive because I was just in such a bad state.
Well, it was soon after that that you mentioned about a year later that your relationship with David sort of got off the ground. Talk about how you met your husband, David French, and the whirlwind nature of your courtship and marriage.
So this also does not reflect well on me. I put everything in this book, as you know.
Well, Nancy, let me interrupt you there because you say that and I understand why from your perspective, you know, that you might think that's true and, you know, and I get that on one level. But I think one of the things that does reflect well on you about is just your complete vulnerability and transparency. I think that's why both my wife and I have found the book so compelling is that, I mean, it's just, it's, I mean, it's pretty raw and pretty real.
It's pretty raw. Yes. And I never wanted to write a book where churches would invite me to speak in the church basement and ask questions, and people would ask me questions about theology. Like, I am not that person. I barely understand God. I don't understand God. I love God. I don't understand God. So I'm not the type of person who will be, you know, showcased at the next Sunday school. But and one of the reasons why is because this is just a lot of these stories are just histories of bad decisions that put me in really bad spots. But man, the spots have been so dramatic and sometimes hilarious. So the way that I met David was when I was a senior in high school, I was not wanting to go to David Lipscomb University in Nashville, which is a Church of Christ college where my parents went and my sisters. It was the only place that they would pay for. And so I was a jerk to the admissions people when they would call me breathlessly excited about me coming to school. So they'd say, "Oh my gosh, are you so excited about coming to Lipscomb?" And I would just make up stuff. And so the first lie I told was, "I'm not excited about going to Lipscomb because I want to go to get into a good veterinarian school. And you can't do that from Lipscomb." The next time it was dental school and you can't from Lipscomb. The next time it was law school and you can't from Lipscomb. I was just trying to insult the school because I was a jerk. And also, I did not want to go to any of these grad schools. I was just making it up. So one day when I made up the law school ruse, the guy said, "You know what? My friend David French just graduated from here and he's at Harvard Law School. Is that good enough for you?" Well, I did not even know how to spell Harvard, and I did not want to go to Harvard. I mean, I would have, obviously, like anybody, but I didn't even know, like I didn't have any law school aspirations at all. But David French had agreed to talk to incoming students. And so he said, "I'll have him call you in a week." So we didn't have, you know, any resources. So I go down to the public library and I try to research Harvard and I get really educated about Harvard Law School. So by the time he calls, I sounded maybe like I knew what I was talking about, but it was all a fake. And then I didn't see him for 3 years. I ran into him. I eventually, because he was older than I, he's 6 years older than I am. So obviously a Harvard law student, it's not going to be dating someone in Paris, Tennessee, who's a senior in high school. But, later we met on the sidewalk at Lipscomb. And when I saw him, I knew who he was because everyone talked about the one guy who'd gone to Harvard Law School. And I said, "Hey, I'm the person, you know, I'm Nancy. I talked to you several years ago. You convinced me to come to this school and I did not like it." And I sort of expressed to him that I was not incredibly happy there. But we talked and we talked and we talked and we talked and I missed my class. We talked for 4 hours. And within, I think, 3 weeks, we were engaged. And within 3 months, we were married. It was insane. But I told everybody at the time, I was like, "I will never get tired of talking to this person. He's the most fascinating person I've ever met in my life." And 28 years later, that is definitely the case. We have the most fascinating conversations. It's been the best marriage ever. I can't believe that it worked out in this way. But, you know, everybody was pretty much opposed to us getting married because he was a complete stranger. But it worked out, you know. So, yeah, it's just I'm very thankful for it.
Well, I know David a little bit, and I can certainly understand what you're saying. I agree that some of the greatest conversations I've had in my life have been with David. Often, I probably shouldn't say this, but often with cigars and with other guys, you know, where David kind of holding court, which is always a lot of fun. But you said that, you know, it's been 28 years and the best marriage ever, but there was a rocky spot in the beginning that involves a famous rock and roll star. Would you tell that story?
Well, everyone was opposed to David and me getting married. And I decided to do exactly what I wanted to do anyway, because who is, you know, who is the deacon at my church to tell me who I should get married to, you know, or who's my, you know, it was like they had friends had interventions. Everybody was opposed to it. So, when David proposed, because I was still in my faking out David French mode where I was trying to be more sophisticated than I was, he proposed and he goes, "Will you marry me?" And I said, "Yeah, but I want to get married in France," because it sounded romantic and it sounded like the type of thing that a Harvard Law grad would want in a future wife, though I'd never been to France, obviously. I had seen Sleepless in Seattle and, Sleepless in Seattle made me want to live in New York. So I lived in, so I wanted to get married in France because I'd seen all the romantic movies about France, but I'd just seen Sleepless in Seattle. So I wanted to live in Manhattan, which was, it sounded like that would also be romantic. And I also did not know anything about Manhattan, but I knew that the Empire State Building was there. It was the only building I knew actually existed in New York City. So I said, yeah, I want to get married in France and I want to live in Manhattan with a view of the Empire State Building. And he said, done. So we moved to New York and we do those two things. We get married in France. We have the apartment where if you crawl out on the fire extinguisher, you can sort of squint and see the Empire State Building, especially at night when it was lit up. It was so romantic. And so then, though, I started wondering if he was maybe having an affair because my phone kept ringing and it was all these sexy, sultry voiced women asking for David. And I would say, oh, he's not here. He's at work. And they would hang up. And this went on and on and on and on. And 2 o'clock in the morning, 3 o'clock in the morning, eventually it goes on for like 3 weeks. And sometimes I would talk to the people more so than others. Sometimes they would just hang up.
Well, and Nancy, let me interrupt you. We should probably mention that David was a lawyer by now and he was working in New York. And sometimes he was out really, really, really late. And you didn't maybe always know exactly what he was doing.
That's right. He said he was working, Warren. He said he was working. But I did not know how law firms worked. And so he would come home at night, like at midnight, drop his briefcase on the floor and he would be exhausted. And I'd say, you missed some calls. And I would toss him a notes and he would look at the women's names and he would say chillingly, huh, I don't even know a Desiree, you know, just weird. Like he was acting like it was no big deal. Not an indication that I'd made the worst decision in my entire life. And so once this lady starts bawling and she was like, I just saw him last night. What do you mean he's not here? He told me he'd be here tomorrow. And I said, where did you see him last night? Because he was supposed to be working last night. And she said, I saw him at a club. And I said, what club? And she goes, in Soho, but his law firm was in Manhattan. So and I was like, are we talking about the same David? He's tall, he's blind. And she was like, yeah. And he wrote down this number on a napkin and she read the number and it was obviously mine. But this time I was just, I'd had it. I knew that I'd made a terrible decision. Ignoring my family was the worst decision in all of the naysayers who were warning us about getting married. So eventually a man calls and I say, I'm so sorry. David's not here. May I take a message? He's at work. And he goes, he's at work. How dare he be at work? All work should go through me. And I was like, well, I don't know how law firms work. I'm thinking this, but maybe he didn't allocate the cases right. I don't know. But I was like, why don't you tell me who you are and I'll have him call you back. And he said, who I am? How dare you? My question to you is, who are you? I've known David for all these years and I've never heard of you. And I was like, well, my name's Nancy and we got married. And he was like, you got married? So upset. And I was like, well, it was spontaneous. We got married in France. Maybe I should have invited you. And he was like, don't go anywhere. I'm coming over. We have to fix this. Don't talk on the phone. And he goes, but first, let me ask you, are you pregnant? And I was like, I'm not pregnant. And he said, because a little David Lee will really hurt our comeback. And I said, David Lee. And at this, he just burst into tears. He's burst into laughter, making fun of me. And I was fighting tears. And he said, you don't even know him, do you? And he was right. I did not know him, but I knew that his middle name was Austin. And I said, are you calling for David Austin French, the attorney? And he goes, no, I'm calling for David Lee Roth, the lead singer of Van Halen. And apparently this man was David Lee Roth's agent. And David Lee Roth had gotten a new phone number. We'd gotten his old phone number randomly when we moved to New York. And David Lee Roth was interacting with women across the city willy-nilly and giving them our phone number, his old phone number. And then they would call us at all hours of the day. And so it was just one of those really hilarious, almost marriage-ending coincidences, the time that David Lee Roth almost ruined my marriage.
Well, it's a great story, but it also, I think in some ways there's a meta lesson there that I took away from it, Nancy, and that is that sometimes if we don't have the right information, we draw the wrong conclusions. And in some ways that even though it was a funny story and an interesting story and a poignant story in the overall arc of your story, it struck me as one of the themes of this book that one of the things that was happening to you and David, as y'all's careers progressed and grew and you became more, you know, kind of a power couple within the GOP and within conservative circles, you started getting some information that you didn't like, that wasn't fitting with the narrative, especially after or right around the 2016 election. Was there a moment for you when you and David decided that you just simply could not follow the GOP any longer?
You know, I always tell people it was when Trump was making fun of John McCain's war service, being a prisoner of war. But I think the real answer is, you know, since I was abused as a kid sexually, I wasn't about that in my political leaders. And so in 98, I wasn't about that when Bill Clinton was revealed to be a sexual predator. And I know that he was revealed to be a sexual predator before then, but I was not aware of it. But he was credibly accused of rape, and by multiple people, by the way. And the church, I remember, was collectively outraged at that. I thought that was the right posture towards Bill Clinton in 98. And I thought that was the right posture towards Trump now. But it did not translate. So the same group of people, they were not equally angered by either. Interestingly, because only one of them has been held liable in court over rape, you know? But anyway, I had the same sort of I was indignant at Clinton's sexual predation and Trump's. And I thought that should be a disqualifier on both counts. So I didn't feel inconsistent. I felt like I was the same person, but for some reason, having the exact same position was intolerable by a lot of people.
Yeah. Well, one of the results of you lost a lot of clients who, you know, were, again, in the Republican power structure that you were ghostwriting for. And, you know, David was working for, I mean, he had worked for Alliance Defending Freedom. He had worked for FIRE. These are two institutions that are, you know, well known in conservative circles. But at some point, y'all kind of became persona non grata in that world. And there was even talk of David running for president on a third party or independent basis. You spend some time in the book describing that. So I'm going to just refer a lot of our, you know, refer our listeners to the book if they want to read more about that. But just in a nutshell, Nancy, what was that experience like for you? What did that tell you about yourself? What did that tell you about the country that we live in?
You know, the title of the chapter where David almost runs for president, I always wanted to write to call that "I Didn't Pack for This," because we were in New York and our kids were about to go to college. So we were sort of experiencing the city, but we were experiencing the city on the cheap, you know, like we had rented a place. Obviously, I didn't have a doorman, you know, like we just were trying to do it. I did not prepare for the fact that my husband might up and run for president. But his name was floated and all chaos broke out. But yeah, it was just one of those things because in that moment, I was so terrified about, you know, just the state of the nation, obviously, but also the when you're outed like this and everyone is talking about you, it is so terrifying because people say they want good people to run for office, but they don't. They want to have someone step up so that they can use them as a pinata. And that's what I was anticipating. But yeah, it was a freaking dramatic summer. But I couldn't go back after that because after that, you know, that time frame where we were speaking out about Trump so vociferously, it was hard to go back to my clients, my Republican clients who wanted me to write positive things about Trump. I just couldn't do it. Also, I didn't feel like God wanted me to do it. Even though that was the job, because ghostwriters aren't supposed to shape necessarily their clients' opinions. They're supposed to report them or convey them appropriately. So I understand why my clients got sick of me.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and you described some interactions with some of your clients where you were trying to insert yourself into the policy questions, and it got uncomfortable for you and for them. Yeah, I can understand why that didn't work out. But where did, from there though, what were you thinking? I mean, you know, you guys were, or, you know, making a pretty good living. You had a lot of clients that were probably paying you pretty well. You were jet setting around the country. You talked for a while about writing the book with Bristol Palin, Sarah Palin's daughter, and how, you know, five of your books ended up on the New York Times bestseller list. It must have been like pulling the rug out from under you, though, financially as well as socially.
Yeah, it was pretty awkward. People love to accuse David French and me of being grifters. We have not figured out how to grift right, apparently, because during that time period, it was like, you know, I lost all my clients and I don't have any other skills. I'm a college dropout. My terminal degree is Henry County High School in Paris, Tennessee. I have no skills. Before I became a ghostwriter, I sold bicycles. I worked at the Huddle House, worked at a catering. You know, it's not like I had this huge career to fall back on. And so, yeah, so I do know how to write. So I started answering ads, job ads, you know, like on monster.com. I don't know what they were, but I could not get hired because I had like five New York Times bestsellers, and I might be like applying to work for an electric company's like corporate response team or something. And I got a few like pity interviews or curiosity interviews where they were like, huh, what's going on here? But no one hired me. But it was okay. Like, you know, sometimes you have to. It's like every Sunday school lesson, you know, like when you were a kid in high school, in Sunday school, where, you know, someone passing around a red Solo cup, what do? I felt like I couldn't partake of that cup anymore because I didn't want to be a part of it. So sometimes there's a cost to that. And for me, it was the cost of my actual occupation.
Yeah. Well, eventually, though, this book comes out, which I don't know how well it's going to do because it's just out, but it sure seems to be doing pretty well. And this is not your first foray into writing in your own voice. We're going to not talk about everything that you've done, but I do want to spend now a few minutes talking about the Kanakuk story. You mentioned that Gretchen Carlson originally reached out to you, but I also know that others did as well, including Elizabeth Phillips. Can you talk a little about how you sort of, from that initial introduction with Gretchen, how you ended up diving into that story and writing what you wrote for the Dispatch?
Yeah, so Gretchen told me about this camp in Missouri that had a NDA issue, a Non-Disclosure Act issue, where a bunch of kids have been abused. The prosecutor estimated hundreds of boys have been abused, but I also heard of girl campers being abused. And then the camp would try to silence those campers through NDAs so that they could never tell their stories. And so that was a pretty draconian and consistent pattern that I noticed when I started looking into it. But there was one family that did not sign the NDA, and I was able to locate them, the Alarcon family in Amarillo, Texas. Stubborn Texans, love them so much. The stubbornness that made them not sign that NDA opened up everything for me because I was able to use those court documents and see what actually happened in Branson, Missouri at Kanakuk camps. And so I just started collecting information and talking to people. And if you look at my phone right now, you'll probably see 300, 400 people labeled Kanakuk. I feel like I've met so many people through Kanakuk, and I cracked so many of the stories. I was able to prove everything I wanted to prove. And I published them in the Dispatch and then Springfield News Leader and then USA Today. So everything that I wanted to prove, I did. And I thought that the church would respond with collective outrage and righteous indignation, but that has not been the case. And that's one of the things that I'll never overcome. I don't think I'll ever get okay with it, is the fact that I was able to prove that this camp had this huge, huge, egregious, terrible sexual abuse cover-up that they're still covering up to this day. The same people who oversaw the abuse are still running the camp today, and the camp is full. And so I'll never get over it. I thought things would be different. I thought the church would respond differently, but they didn't.
Yeah. So, Nancy, given that, I mean, what's your prescription? I mean, the Canacook story, your book, Ghosted, in some ways, I would suggest are a massive diagnosis of what's wrong with the church, what's wrong with the ministry space, in some ways, what's wrong with our political space. If that diagnosis is accurate, what's the cure? What's the prescription? What does Nancy French offer as a solution?
I don't have any solutions politically. Maybe David French does. Y'all may know he writes for the New York Times. He writes about politics all the time. I do not. I feel like the solution is stepping outside of that. And instead, I don't mind having a partisan mindset. I'm no longer a member of the GOP because of the whole Trump situation in 2016. I don't think I'll ever go back. But I think it's important to have deeply held political beliefs. I have those. And I can't change those, or I won't change those unless I get more information. And, you know, hopefully we are always changing closer to truth. But I just don't think that that politics can't save us. And so instead of having this partisan mindset that categorizes everybody as us versus them, having a more the mindset of Christ and approaching people with love and developing relationships with people in a cross-partisan way, even a post-partisan way. Like, it's not I don't care. When I meet people, I am thankful that there are people who professionally care about the marginal tax rate or immigration policies and stuff like that. I'm just not smart enough to do that. I literally don't even have a college degree. I just wanted to tell my story because I was like the Forrest Gump of politics. I was everywhere that politics was happening for a long time. And so I got to see what was happening and I got to see what was wrong. But I just don't think that there are answers in this world that can fix this. I feel like God is so gracious to us and that he wants us to have healing and he wants our nation to be reconciled. And these awful divisions, I think he wants those to disappear. And we can do that. We can do that at the grocery store. We can do that with our neighbors. We can do that at the Thanksgiving dinner table without being a complete jerk to your uncle that you don't like his politics. There's just ways to do it. And I used to go to Fox News, and my spiritual gift not listed in 1 Corinthians was, making Americans drink liberal tears. I love sarcasm. I love jokes. I love eviscerating people, putting people on a skillet. And then I realized I was part of the problem. And so this is sort of my mea culpa confession. We can do better. We do not have to treat each other as enemies. And also, I feel like we should really, as Christians, think about, I'm a Christian. As Christians, we should think about not bearing false witness against our neighbor. Because that's what I was doing when I was doing all these talking points for these clients. It wasn't my clients necessarily. They weren't the ones who were necessarily wanting me to do all of this. That's just my natural inclination is acrimony. I like to be funny and make jokes and, you know, whatever. And it gets me in trouble, but it didn't get me in trouble because it made me popular amongst the GOP because I had that sort of panache where I could make fun of people and whatever. So anyway, I realized that was not the right way to be. That was not why God gave me my writing talent. That's not why God gave me my sense of humor. And I was actually wrong. And I'd mischaracterized. What I'd do is I would, you know, some liberal in Topeka would do something nuts. And I'd say, well, isn't that great? That's just how liberals are. You know, that's just how they are. And it's not true. You know, you take one person, just like if you are a Christian and somebody can find some person in Appalachia that said something that was not as Christian as they should have been. And then they say, well, this is how Christians are. It's how they truly believe. It's not logical and it's also not kind.
Yeah. I call that practice nut picking, Nancy, where we look for the biggest nut on the team on our opponent's team. And we try to represent that person as representative of the team rather than the crazy uncle. The other the thing that I, a phrase that comes to mind when you say that is that I think as Christians, we have to be careful that we don't become what we hate, or at least what we say we hate. And that is that if I think you're absolutely dead on right, that the real sin here is bearing false witness. And if as conservatives and as Christians, I think that we do have a truer story to tell to the world than the progressive worldview. But I think that means that we have a responsibility to tell it truly, that we have to tell that true story with true words. And if we bear false witness in order to make our story sound more plausible, then we're just doing what we're accusing the other side of doing.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And I think now that I'm nearing 50, it's just like, I don't care about brand management as much. I mean, you can tell I put everything in this book. And I just feel like life is too short to try to convince everybody that you're really awesome and you've got it figured out. This book, if anything, is the opposite of that.
Well, Nancy, you said a few moments ago that, you know, in this book, you just wanted to tell your story. And I want to give you permission to not answer this question. You know, we talked about it a little bit before we went on the air, but a part of your story is unfolding even now. People that follow you on social media or follow your husband, David, on social media know that you've got cancer, that you've been fighting this now for a while, that it's serious. First of all, I'm sorry about that. And you can be sure that I have been and will continue to pray for you and for David and your family. Anything you want to say about that? Any lessons God has taught you during this season?
Well, I get choked up, Warren, every time I think about it, but I'm so moved by, you know, we professional pundits or whatever, and I don't really count myself at that, but we lament social media a ton about how awful it is. It's the armpit of, you know, human existence or whatever. But I am so thankful. I was sort of outed as a cancer patient through a weird circumstance. So I decided to just shave my head and put a picture on Twitter of me being bald. And there was something so sweet about the outpouring of love that people have given me. It's been so enveloping and wonderful. And I know that I've always been negative about social media, but this love that I've experienced through this has been so amazing. I've heard from so many people. I've connected with so many people who have cancer. A lot of people have a cancer that is incurable, or cancer that is not responding to chemo, or cancer that it does X, Y, or Z that's different from mine. And it's just been wonderful to connect with people and to actually grapple with death. I think grappling with death is like a super important life hack, because I've never felt more alive than since my diagnosis. I feel, I'm puking my guts out, and my body is betraying me in ways that I won't embarrass you to describe. But yeah, there's something about being cognizant of death and holding death close to you that sort of makes you feel more alive. I think the Stoics called it memento mori, remember that you must die. And I feel like we need to, it's a topic that we don't like to talk about because it's so uncomfortable, but I feel like being cognizant of our death is super important. And as Christians, you know, whatever happens after death, you know, it's beautiful. So like, we have answers to this. And I do believe that God will restore all things. So anyway, yeah. So it's the cancer stuff really stinks and it's awful. And I've made so many friends and I'm accepting the love of so many of you guys. And I love all of you so much. And I just want you to know that I appreciate you.
Well, Nancy, that's a good word, and I do want to end on that. Though I also, at the risk of stepping on that beautiful last word, is there anything else that you want to share with folks? Is that it? Is that the last word? That love is what lasts.
Yeah, I think that love is what lasts, and it's the only thing that matters. And so, if you find out that your new friend belongs to the opposite political party or believes X, Y, or Z differently than you do about Gaza, just don't let that be the only data point that you're considering in your friendships. There's so many beautiful people out there who disagree with you politically. And sometimes that's a deal breaker. It depends what the issue is, but most of the time it's not. And developing relationships with people with whom you disagree is the most beautiful thing. It's so it allows you to see different perspectives, but it also allows you to know that people love you, you know, for something other than just your resume or your, you know, thoughts. And so hopefully as Americans, we should be able to do that.
Nancy French, thank you so much for being on the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, that brings to a close my conversation with Nancy French. Her new book is Ghosted, An American Story. I should say that Ministry Watch did its own investigation of Canico Camps, and you can find our stories by going to ministrywatch.com and hitting the Investigations tab at the top of the page. Now, before we go, a quick note for our regular listeners. We had one of our best weeks ever on the podcast last week with nearly 4,000 podcast downloads in a single week, which for us is a lot. And we have had so far about 15,000 downloads for the month of April. Again, one of our better months. Now, if you're a regular listener, I want to say thanks for your support because you are included in those numbers that I just mentioned. But I do have a favor to ask of you. If you've never rated us or left us a comment on your podcast app, I'd really like to encourage you to do so. Your ratings are an encouragement to me personally. I read them all. And they make a difference to the algorithms that help other people discover us. The more ratings we have, and the more that the algorithm can link your rating to other podcasts you listen to, it will suggest the Ministry Watch podcast to others in ways that I don't quite understand and don't even really love. But that is the game, and, you know, we sort of got to play it. And it's a small and non-financial way that you can be a big help to the podcast. Just rate us, like us, share us on social media. It really does make a big difference. Thanks for your help. The producer for today's program is Jeff McIntosh. We get database and editorial support from Stephen DeBerry, Christina Darnell, Kim Roberts, and Rod Pitzer. I'm your host, Warren Smith, and until next time, may God bless you.